KBOO Portland, it's 8:59. The Olmo Variety Hour is next.
Hey, Jenna here from the show Pacific Underground, the radio show that explores the Asian and Pacific Islander experience in America. We're looking for producers and writers to join our team. So we're inviting those who identify as Asian or Pacific Islander to attend a Pacific Underground information meeting on Wednesday, April 26th at 7 p.m. at KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue at Burnside. More information can be found at www.pacificunderground.org or on our Facebook at PAC Underground.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Lonesome City EP release, Saturday, April 29th at the Alberta Street Pub in Portland. The event celebrates the debut solo EP release from Avery Levine. Avery Levine is a Portland-based singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist specializing in traditional Irish music and original progressive Irish folk. Again, that's the Lonesome City EP release, Saturday, April 29th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Alberta Street Pub, 1036 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically-run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Todd Sloan. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering today. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. On today's program, helping us focus our energies for May Day solidarity in action, we explore teaching in poverty schools, the tragedy of it, and some wonderful possibilities, a reading on the long history of scientific experimentation on people of color in the U.S., a report on the recent Portland Troublemakers School, and the Old Mole's weekly community action calendar. Leading off today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Alex Diamond, who has taught in the U.S., Asia, and Latin America, on the topic of teaching in a poor school in Memphis, Tennessee. Bill?
Thank you, Todd. Alex Diamond, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill.
Alex Diamond is an educator. He writes. He's taught in Korea, in Peru, Colombia. His first position was in Memphis, Tennessee, in a black urban poverty school. He's written several essays on that school, including the major issue of today's, written on the major issue for today's interview. The essay is titled Under Pressure: The Unintended Consequences of Education Reform. That education reform, I put it in quotes. That essay is coming out this year in a book, Inside Our Schools, Teachers on the Failure and Future of Education Reform. First, Alex, tell us, how did you manage to wind up in a 99.9% black urban high school in Memphis, Tennessee? And what was it like as a beginning teacher? How well were you prepared?
Well, I think my preparation was pretty inadequate, in all honesty. I did a program called Teach for America, and like most people who do it, I did it straight out of college. So I was 22 years old, actually 21 when I started the program. And the idea of the program is it takes recent college graduates, mainly from elite universities, and places them into low-performing I think the student body, Teach for America's own numbers say 90% black and Latino, but low-performing, low-income schools.
And they have sort of a theory, right, that these very smart kids from good grades too, right?
Well, yes.
You had reasonably good grades.
Somehow I got through the hiring process. Right. The idea is that these very high-performing, again, mainly from elite school students, are going to be able to come in and fix inner-city schools. And there's a racial narrative in this as well.
Right. Because they could relate to kids somehow. And for some reason, people believe that they are really good at building engaging curriculums.
Well, I actually don't think it has to do with relating to kids necessarily. That may be true. I think it's kind of coming from a high-achieving place into a low-achieving place. It kind of implies an attitude of, you know, that this is a different part of America. Teach for America has recently made kind of more efforts to involve teachers of color, but it's still pretty limited. So that there's a bit of a narrative of people from high achieving backgrounds and high achieving contexts, which tend to be white, middle, upper class, and elite universities.
Yeah. How well were you prepared? What happened in your first months in the school? I understand it was pretty stressful.
Well, yes, I was. I think that's probably true for any first-year teacher, but I think I was pretty unprepared. I was teaching world history my first year and then also world geography my second. And my training was a 5-week summer institute. And during that institute, there was student teaching, but I actually taught math. So, you know, unlike traditional teacher education programs, which may put prospective teachers in as like a student teacher where they're mentored, I had that, but for math. So I sort of...
And for 5 weeks, not for several semesters with,
correct.
With a real mentor teacher in the school interacting with other teachers.
Right.
I mean, you came in green as green can be almost.
Yes, I did. And, you know, I sort of understood, I think I wrote about this, I understood the education gap, but it's in a sort of abstract way, but it's a different thing to actually, you know, bring in materials, you know, primary source materials that you think are going to shock the students, outrage them, and then realize that their reading level is just not where it needs to be to comprehend them, even if they're trying.
Yeah, we'll talk about the curriculum that you did finally develop, right? It took you a long time, I understand. That really was engaging and good, although you had more freedom in the school than most of the teachers to innovate. We'll talk about that. I'd like to really talk about that at the end of the interview, where near the end, so that we can go over why still even quite quick and bright kids who were trying to learn, they were unable to score well enough on college placement tests or any of it, even to be considered college ready. Not one kid in your school was, apparently. But we'll get into that. This is KABU Radio, 90.7, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Alex Diamond, an educator, a writer. He's taught all over the world. His first job was in Memphis, Tennessee, in a black urban school. He's discussed how completely stressed and unprepared he was to teach in a 99% black school. Alex, to complicate things, when you went down there, it was in the midst of the imposition of, quote, educational reform. And educational reform just added to the burdens of teachers and, in fact, left them much less able, my understanding, to fashion a curriculum which really excited and engaged the students. But tell us about what happened.
Okay, yeah. Well, at the time that we're talking about, which was 2008 to 2010, educational reform meant No Child Left Behind. And there have been changes that are maybe improvements after that policy essentially failed. But I think the pressures are sort of the same. And essentially, my school was a failing school. It had been classified as a failing school. And we were in danger of getting fresh started, which means it's basically a way of saying that the school is broken and we need to eliminate when to get rid of the administrators and teachers who are there and start over, fresh start.
And sometimes giving it to private schools. I mean, hiring in some districts.
In Memphis, it actually ended up, they formed an achievement school district, and they ended up doing it a lot with charter schools.
Uh-huh.
So that is true. Anyway, that sort of fear permeated the discourse around education reform or around even school improvement and education in the school, to the extent that in our staff meetings, our principal would talk about, I wrote about this, you know, rolling up the buses to sort of ship everyone out, you know, saying very concretely, you could lose your jobs if we don't meet these statistical benchmarks. So that was one thing that kind of made for a damaging negative environment. But another was that the specific statistical pressures ended up manifesting themselves in ways that went very much against the goals.
Tell us what these performance measures did, how they affected teaching.
Well, there are two measures that the policy used and that are still used often. One, standardized tests. Standardized test scores are absolutely crucial and are probably the sort of the number one way that schools and teachers are evaluated. And the other was graduation rate. So one example that I wrote about was that our graduation rate in order to avoid being classified as a failing school needed to be 90%, and it was 67%. So we were way off. So administrators responded to this pressure that we need to graduate 90% of our students.
That is, you're going to lose your job unless you...
Basically, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you're on the streets if you don't...
Essentially,
90%,
yes. Yeah. They instituted a rule, you know, thinking that why do students not graduate? Well, it's because they fail their classes. Of course, the ways that poverty and the things that students are dealing with at home are all very relevant. And you know, all over the country, schools in what are termed at-risk communities, but poor communities with low employment rates, drug problems, gangs.
Lack of jobs.
They generally have
hunger at the end of the month.
Hunger at the beginning of the day.
Yeah, at the beginning of the day.
My snack drawer was often raided by hungry students, and I couldn't blame them for it.
A lot of teachers dip into their income enormously to give kids supplies and things, and
certainly,
and buy toilet paper for the school and all the rest of the things that poor urban schools do not get.
Well, we did have toilet paper, I can say. So anyway, based on this need to raise up the graduation rate, the school administrators decided, well, we need 90% of kids to graduate. Therefore, we need 90% of kids to pass their classes. Therefore, we're going to institute a rule that says that 90% of students in each class need to pass. In other words, they were attempting to take control over teachers' grades. And there's a couple ways to look at it. One is that, like, if half of your students or if 30% of your students are failing, that, you know, maybe that is a problem with the teacher. Another way to look at it is that, and this was true for me, like significantly less than 90% of my students even attended class 50% of the time. I mean, there were students with all kinds of issues outside of school.
Responsibilities at home to take care of younger kids. For example.
Yeah, that would be one. Or, you know, every situation is different, but poverty tends to create these situations.
Right.
And, you know, that's not talking about doing homework, and that's not talking about, in my case, you know, actually understanding the class content about world history or world geography. So in this case, And I think in many low-income schools or low-performing schools, students sort of get pushed along. And it's taking power away from teachers, and it also creates sort of a negative atmosphere, negative dynamic, where students know that teachers have to pass them. And that was something that even entered into my conversations with students.
Students, they knew they had to graduate high school to get that credential if they were going to get a job. And so they really had to have, they had to graduate. So they sort of begged you just to pass them, even though they hardly went to class. And
well, that was...
And some kids. Yeah. Alex, there's sort of other ones. Why don't you summarize pretty briefly the question of the test, teaching to the test, and the demands on, not you though, because your world history wasn't tested, but for the rest of most of the teachers in the school, their kids were rigorously tested to see whether they've gotten it, were able to deal with the minutiae of math or whatever it is. American history, knowing the dates, you know, all the stuff that they test on in multiple choice tests. It seems to me there's a lot of teaching for the test, I suppose, and test prep took a lot of time. Tell us about that briefly, and then we'll get into your curriculum.
Well, you're 100% right that there is a lot. And I think one thing to highlight is that in higher performing, higher income, generally wider schools, this is much less of an issue. Because students are passing these tests. So the pressures are not the same. And teachers have a lot more freedom to make creative curriculum that engages students and improves their baseline skills, be it reading, writing, math, and their understanding. So they don't need to teach test prep strategies. What happens in schools, well, for example, mine, where teachers are facing the loss of their jobs, and students may not have that reading level or may not have the basic mathematical ability to pass those tests based on a normal curriculum, is that I think the strategy that makes most sense to teachers and that's pushed by administrators, which happened in my school as well, is teaching to the test. So just as an example, if a student in Algebra 1 is not able to do Algebra 1 curriculum, and they are still pushed along to Algebra 2, then you have a situation where a teacher's, I mean, even now, pay or job future may be tied to that student passing an Algebra 2 test. So the teacher has kind of a decision, do I go back and teach the basis of this curriculum, Algebra 1, so that the student really understands that and then can sort of start moving forward? Or do I teach strategies that can help the student pass this test, maybe guarantee my job, but like eliminating answers?
Bill Resnick here on KABU 90.7 FM Portland, talking to Alex Diamond about teaching in a black urban public school in Memphis, how completely unprepared he was and how the imposition of high-stakes testing and performance measures made things so much worse for the teachers in the school who were... He's written on that in the... In,
about 1 minute.
Oh, Alex, you got to know your students really well. You, in fact, were a basketball coach. You got to know parents. You stayed after school with the basketball kids. The one thing the school had was a championship basketball team for the state of Tennessee in your last year teaching there. And in any event, you really knew them. You developed a curriculum. Tell us about it. A lot of the kids, in fact, got engaged, wrote good essays, but still they couldn't do well enough on the battery of tests that they took to be called college ready. Tell us, give us a sense of how, of what's happened with those students and how did that happen?
Well, Bill, you mentioned earlier that I was fortunate that I did not have a tested subject, which actually world history normally is around the country, but in Tennessee it wasn't. So I was able to use a social justice-based curriculum that I in part developed. I want to give a lot of credit to Rethinking Schools, an organization that produces tremendous curriculum. So I was teaching about globalization in the modern world and relating it to inequalities, especially around racial issues that students lived every day. And in doing that, I think students were more engaged and were reading and wanted to read these materials and wanted to argue about them.
Wanted to discuss and debate, come to class.
And write. And for some students anyway, it was motivating and inspiring. But again, I was very fortunate to be able to do this. And I think there's a lot of teachers who would love to be able to do that, like in their English classes, and there are materials available. But they're not able to.
Alex, we're being asked to wrap up, please, which we will. That was Alex Diamond. You can read so much more on of Alex Diamond's work and his analysis of the Black urban high school that he taught at and coached basketball as well, assistant coach, in his essay, Under Pressure, The Unintended Consequences of Education Reform, and his previous essays. It'll be published. In fact, the book is almost in publication, Inside Our Schools, Teachers on the Failure and Future of Education Reform.
It's coming out next month, Bill.
Coming out next month. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thank you, Bill.
That was Velvet Underground's Beginning to See the Light, following Bill Resnick's illuminating interview with Alex Diamond. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next, Desiree Heligers reads an excerpt from Craig Steven Wilder's Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of American Universities. It illuminates the long history of medical experimentation on people of color in the U.S., and that challenges claims about scientific practice as liberatory, environmentally friendly, and insulated from dominant ideologies. Desiree?
What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason! How infinite in faculties! In form and moving, how express and admirable! In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth. This goodly frame, the earth seems to me a sterile promontory.
This most excellent canopy, the air, look you. This brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof, fretted with golden fire. Why, it appears no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors.
So I'm going to be doing a reading this morning from Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities by Craig Steven Wilder. And it is published in 2013, and is part of a kind of deeper examination that's going on across the country of the ways in which universities in the U.S. are implicated in the long history of slavery and the medical dissection and exploitation of people of color. You can hear Wilder interviewed in a couple of segments of Democracy Now! That are available online. And I think this is a book that should be required reading at every university in the U.S. So if you're having a really stressful morning, you might not enjoy this reading. As early as 1648, the Reverend John Eliot had observed that plantations needed anatomists to advance religious work among Indians by countering the powwows with science. The Puritan missionary recognized the strategic benefits of spreading European science and the social rewards of allowing colonial doctors to improve their skills. Eliot did not believe that dissection would discover eternal differences or racial divisions between Indians and Christians. Rather, he may have been encouraged by a contemporaneous event. Giles Furman, a graduate of Cambridge University, who became a gentleman farmer and physician in Ipswich, Massachusetts, performed a dissection for students interested in medicine. Furman's anatomy lesson came just prior to Eliot's call for instructional dissections. In the following century, the governors of Harvard took up the task of promoting anatomy. In the summer of 1712, the trustees resolved to give the students the opportunity to dissect once in 4 years some malefactor and the court that the court could provide. The genesis of American medical science corresponded to the rise of anatomy and the ascent of the concept of race. The study of anatomy as the foundation of medicine is a truth so well established and so universally acknowledged as to leave no room for observation, William Nisbet wrote in his compilation of the Edinburgh Medical Curriculum. Race governed the intellectual cultures of the Atlantic world. Nisbet's exploration of anatomy started by asserting that racial difference, like sex, was certain. Anatomical dissection, in particular, promised answers to questions about the nature of humankind that had lingered in science and theology. On his return journey from a 1773 trip to South Carolina, Josiah Quincy Jr. attended a lecture of young Dr. Shippen at the Philadelphia Medical College. Quincy was highly impressed with Shippen's knowledge, but even more taken with the facilities. The curiosities of this hospital are far beyond anything of the kind in North America. Shortly after the founding of Dartmouth, Dr. Joseph Lewis, a personal physician to President Eleazar Wheelock, peeled the skin from the body of a deceased black man named Cato and boiled the corpse in a kettle to free the skeleton for study. He took Cato's skin to be tanned at the shop that served the college, then used it to dress his instrument case. Physicians, surgeons, and students on numerous campuses conducted anatomical dissections and created anatomical specimens decades before their institutions opened medical schools. Human bodies were even more of a commodity once medical programs were organized. Dartmouth's faculty struggled with the legislation to access corpses, an issue that drove one of its founding faculty, Nathan Smith, to Yale. There were other ways to acquire bodies. In 1811, Dartmouth's medical school moved into its own building, where the basement was soon piled with human and non-human bones. The medical students entertained themselves with this collection by using it to terrorize the campus and the town at night. A number of those skeletons were likely those of enslaved and free black people who had worked for Dartmouth. Although slavery was declining in New Hampshire, the college had been one of the largest slaveholders in the colony and the state, and the officers buried enslaved and free black laborers in the college cemetery. The medical profession and medical schools in colonial North America were founded on the bodies of the poor and subjected. Harvard's governors expected that the corpses of criminals would be transferred to the school, just as John Eliot had assumed that Indians could be dismembered. However, Christians generally judge the value of science apart from the appropriateness or morality of scientific techniques. The introduction of anatomy to North American colleges was disquieting, since there was little consensus about whose bodies could be breached. Okay, again, this is a reading from Craig Stephen Wilder's Ebony and Ivy. Colonial students who studied in Europe had already experienced the social tensions caused by instructional dissection. The elder Alexander Monroe moved his anatomy classes out of the Surgeon's Hall to the Edinburgh campus to hide from the public. In April 1725, a mob attacked his students for stealing corpses from the nearby Greyfriars Kirkyard. The administration paid soldiers to protect the University of Glasgow from mobs seeking to retaliate against the medical faculty. When the governors proposed relocating the anatomy labs to the new Hunterian Museum, the staff protested that such a move would make them the targets of violence. William Hunter studied and researched at Glasgow and Edinburgh before moving to London, where he took advantage of new regulations that allowed for instructional dissection in medical corpses. John Hunter began his career helping his brother secure bodies for his popular anatomical lectures, which used Parisian-style interactive learning. Glasgow's faculty and students ultimately began exploiting their proximity to Ireland to meet their needs without disturbing their city. In the 1830s, a scandal involving murders to supply corpses shook Edinburgh and claimed the career of the leading anatomist, Robert Knox. On April 20th, 1773, Daniel Hughes published a notice for an anatomy class for midwives and practitioners in Providence, Rhode Island. He claimed a lengthy career in surgery and medicine, familiarity with a wealth of medical texts, and a reputation among leading physicians. For a nominal fee, Hughes offered medical instruction or consultations on medical cases. As evidence of his professional standing and accomplishment, he added that the governor of Massachusetts had awarded him the body of a Negro malefactor, which he wired into a skeleton for use as a teaching tool and guide for setting bones and joints. White people also still had ample reason to worry about their fate after death. In 1764, the King's College trustee, John Watts, promised Robert Governor Monckton that he would recommend the addition of an anatomist to the faculty, but warned that there was little hope of success given a lack of funds and a shortage of students. Popular disdain for doctors and medical training contributed to his doubts. "We have so many of the faculty already destroying His Majesty's good subjects," Watts joked, "than the public had rather one half were hanged that were already practicing than breed up a new swarm." Such fears affected every level of society. Later in the century, President George Washington's deathbed instructions to his family, friends, and personal slave, William Lee, included a reminder to have me decently buried and do not let my body be put into the vault in less than 3 days after I am dead. Money and status provided some comfort in death, such as the security of being placed in church tombs and vaults in fenced churchyards, practices that acquired new social meaning in the age of anatomy. Captain Jasper Farmer, the slave trader and merchant whose servants helped organize the 1741 conspiracy in Manhattan, was shot aboard the ship Charming Jenny by sailors whom he was trying to impress into service during the French and Indian War. His militia company escorted his body to Trinity Church, where it was interred next to the altar. In 1788, his wife, Maria Farmer, died. Her funeral followed the ancient Dutch custom. Mourners enjoyed spiced wine and tobacco pipes before accompanying her body from her home at Hanover Square to the church. The coffin was draped in black cloth with a Dutch epigraph on a copper plaque. She was entombed next to her husband at Trinity in a service presided over by Anglican and Dutch clergy. Slave trading had purchased the farmers some eternal comfort. Most corpses had no such protections. By 1769, Joseph Warren, a student at Harvard, had organized an underground anatomy club. His younger brother, John Warren, later transformed this group into a secret society, the Spunkers, to procure human bodies for instruction. Their adventures included sneaking about in the evening in boats, in carts, and on foot, looking for new graves. John Warner did most of his demonstrations with the assistance of 7 Harvard students who went on to successful medical careers. The American Revolution advanced the medical arts in Cambridge by generating a reliable supply of British and Hessian dead. In 1782, the year before the British surrender, Harvard's trustees established a medical college and appointed John Warren to the first professorship in anatomy and surgery. The war also accelerated the professionalization of medicine in New Haven, where a medical society emerged immediately after the peace. Human tissue was the currency of medical science. An advertisement for an anatomy corps in Philadelphia promised real human body parts. The medical factory at Columbia organized medical faculty. You could say the medical factory at Columbia organized an association to encourage the study of surgery and anatomy. Doctors at Rutgers Medical College on Duane Street in New York lured students with assurances that its anatomy professors teaches with the knife, dissecting in front of the class, displaying and describing the pieces, and offering opportunities for student interaction and private instruction. In 1789, New York began formally supplying medical colleges and doctors with the cadavers of executed felons, a controversial postmortem punishment and extension of the power of the state. The legislation also assigned penalties for grave robbing. Aristotelian notions that accepted the viability of the lower classes failed to resonate in a society inching toward republicanism. In 1765, the year that Shippen became professor of anatomy at Philadelphia, a mob of sailors violently interrupted his class, destroyed his lab, confiscated severed human limbs, attacked his carriage, and vandalized his house. The tensions were not limited to the city of brotherly love. Wealthier people who lived near a hospital or a medical college sat graveside by the burial of relatives or friends, hired watchmen to look after the deceased, and even exhumed caskets to confirm that bodies had not been resurrected. So this has been a reading from Craig Stephen Wilder's Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of American Universities. I offered to you as a co-an, and I'm not going to provide the answer today. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Desiree Heliger's reading from Craig Stephen Wilder's Ebony and Ivy. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now we have a report on the recent Portland Troublemakers School. In the aftermath of the November election, unions are facing a host of challenges. On April 8, 2017, Labor Notes was in town for the Portland Troublemakers School to help union members and organizers understand and learn to fight back against such challenges as right-to-work legislation, Republican-led healthcare reform, and school privatization. Elizabeth Teal, Vice President of the Portland Association of Teachers, participated in the workshop, Labor in the Trump Era, The Big Picture, and discussed the very real threat of privatization to public schools nationally and in Oregon. This segment was produced by the Old Mole, Denise Morris, with an introduction by Director of Labor Notes, Mark Brenner.
Everywhere we have seen government services being provided over the last 20 years, we've seen this encroachment on the public sector. More and more private corporations are trying to actually come into government work, and why? Why are they doing it? Money, right? In the end of the day, more and more corporations are looking at our federal, state, and local budgets and saying, I want to get a piece of that pie because I can make a healthy chunk of change doing that work. And unfortunately, when you start introducing profiteering into provision of public services, doesn't work out so good. Now we've got a whole new foray in which we're kind of face to face with that risk here in the country. In the Trump era, we're going to talk about the place where it probably is coming first and hardest, which is in our public schools and in public education. We have Elizabeth Teal, Vice President of the Portland Association of Teachers, here to talk to us a little bit about this privatization threat.
Thanks
Elizabeth.
Yeah. Have you heard of Betsy DeVos?
Mm.
Yeah, good. So one thing I think is great about President Trump is that he's really brought this thing about school choice and privatization to the forefront, because when it was Obama and Arne Duncan pushing school choice, we didn't talk about it as much. But now we get to talk about it, so that's really good. Mm-hmm. So you've heard of school choice. It sounds really good. Who doesn't want choices? But like Mark said, school choice, which is the very clearly the intention of the Trump administration and Betsy DeVos, is to put school choice in every state, and that means charter schools, vouchers, education, savings accounts, and tax credits, which I'll tell you guys a little bit about. And it sounds good, because they say it's about giving choices to the most vulnerable students. It's about letting every family decide what's best for their kid, and who's going to say no to that. But what it's really about is dismantling the system that our country fought hard for, to have a free and appropriate public education for every child that is guaranteed, regardless of whether they behave well or act a certain way or have a certain set of beliefs, in their community as close as possible to home. That's very much in danger of going away. Civil rights are very much under attack. And ultimately, it's about opening up the funding that we have set aside. We believe our community wants to give to education of all of our children. It's opening up that funding for profiteers. You guys have probably heard of charter schools. They've been around a long time. Betsy DeVos has worked, you know, well, I don't know, worked isn't really the right word. She's a billionaire. She was born into billions and married into more billions, and she's got plenty of money, and she's been using that money to fight for charters to be opened up. In her home state of Michigan, they have a huge charter program. What that means, the amount of money that the state allocates to a student for public education then goes to a private operator. And that private operator does not have the same set of rules as a public school would have. They get to do it their own way. One of the ways that applies to us in this room is that charter schools don't have to reunionize. In a state where teachers are union, charter school teachers are not. So they can pay them less. They have worse working conditions. They like churn. So a lot of charter schools operate on the idea that you work teachers real hard for 2 or 3 years, and then they burn out, and that's okay, because there's other desperate people willing to do anything for a buck. Organizations like Teach for America have made that really a viable model, because they're churning people in with the only expectation to be a teacher for a couple years. Vouchers, a lot of people don't like the word voucher, and so that's why we haven't heard it as much in the last 10 years. But vouchers are where the state just gives a family the amount of money that they would have paid for public education and says, do with it what you want. You can go to a religious school, you can just take it and be at a home school, you can enroll in an online charter school. All of those things, it's your money, it's your choice. But what a voucher provides, if you're using that money for a private school, it means tax dollars are going to religious organizations a lot of the time. It means that the private school does not have to accept you. If your child has a special need, the private school is very much allowed to say, I'm sorry, we don't serve that need here. Or if your child does not behave the way the school expects, they have every right to say, I'm sorry, our school doesn't work for you, please go to another school. And the real impact that these programs have on public schools is, number one, a dismantling of the system. So when you have students leave public school, that's less funding for the school, which means the school offers less services, which means families say, why doesn't my school offer everything that it should? And it means a concentration of students with greater needs, because if charter schools and private schools don't have to take them, well, public schools, our mission is to serve every child. We accept and make room for every child. And when we're encouraging families to leave the public schools if they can, it means the families remaining are a greater concentration of need, but with ever diminishing resources. So that's the plan. So it's very much about taking the foundation out of our public school system. And in some states, we're seeing that happen. We might lose public education as we know it. This has already happened in Louisiana. In New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, they just took away public schools. They don't have them anymore. I think the last public school in New Orleans closed this year, is that right? And the rest are charter. And families sometimes have to go to one school and another and say, will you take my child? Will you take my child? Until they finally get to a school, kind of going down the tiers, that finally will take their child or not. And so it creates a tiered system where schools get to decide what kind of student they serve. They get to decide what requirements go with that education. And families, although they're told they have a choice, they actually have far fewer choices than they have now. So, what does this have to do with us in Oregon? Isn't everything great here? We would never want a system like that. And actually, the Network for Public Education just recently put out a grading system for all the states. We got a D on their scale. Oregon does have charter schools. Oregon does have online charter schools now. And Oregon has had, in the last 8 or 10 years, a history of taking money from public education and putting it into these privatization vehicles like grants. There was a board called the OEIB that just took money and said, we're going to use this not for public school allocation, but for private projects that groups come to us and want to do. And this is another way that privatization has really been gaining steam here in Oregon. So at the state level, at this point, I don't think Oregon has any of these privatization tax schemes that I've seen in some other states. There are states right now where on the ballot are things like private school tax credits. If you are a wealthy person and want to give $1 million to a private school, you can do that and then get that back as a tax credit. There's a plan, I think, in Ohio where it's called education savings accounts, where families can choose to have the funding for public education not go to the school but go into a savings account, which they can use for anything. And then that family is no longer funding public education. So the way it works right now, we all pay into public education whether we have students or not, because we believe that we want a society where everybody has a right to an education. These systems are giving people the option. Would you rather pay for somebody's public education through your tax dollars, or would you just rather have a check for $8,000? Some people might choose the check. All around the state, we've got school board races going on. I think, does everyone have school board elections right now? In Portland, we have a school board election in May. We have 3 open seats. In one of the seats, the candidate who's very likely going to win at this point is Julia Brim Edwards, who's a Nike executive and who has been fighting against corporations paying their fair share of taxes. The candidate that PAT had endorsed is no longer campaigning. Trisha Parks, she's still going to be in the ballot, she can still vote for her. But Julia was going to win. In another race, we have Rita Moore, who PAT is endorsing, running against Jamila Munson Singleton, who works for Teach for America. That's her current employment. And this is a big concern to us, because Teach for America has a mission of putting people in public schools for a short amount of time. This has had the impact of de-unionizing districts. In Chicago, unionized teachers got laid off in order to make room for Teach for America, short-term teachers. And Teach for America, their mission is to, they have had a long-standing history of fighting unionization and claiming that teaching experience and teaching education is not what makes a qualified teacher. What makes a qualified teacher is coming through Teach for America with minimal training, staying in a classroom for a couple years, and then moving on to become a decision maker in the field of education or a business leader who claims experience in education. And they support people to run for offices. And so we're seeing that hit Portland. What that's going to mean for us if she wins, I don't know, but this is a strategy that's happening around the nation. Is the people who are pushing for privatization, the corporations, the Broad Foundation, the Walton Family Foundation, are actively trying to get school board candidates who will support a privatization agenda at the local level. And I heard a statistic a few years ago that something like 70% of school board members in the United States had been trained by the Broad Foundation, Eli Broad. They've made it their philanthropic project to train school board members. That's a little bit about privatization and education. I think the bottom line with that is this is a civil rights issue. The choice movement says that they're all about civil rights, giving choices to the students with the most need, but we know that the data is very clear that school choice does not benefit the students with the greatest need. They're the ones who end up without any choices. It has been a way for, and this is true in Portland and across the country, it's a way of families with more resources tend to move out of schools and move into more homogenous populations so that their student is kind of in a bubble of students without the needs that they see in more diverse schools. Privatization in the Trump era.
That segment on Portland Troublemaker School was produced by Denise Morris, followed by Neil Young's Round and Round. It won't be long. Speaking of it won't be long, we on the Old Mole feel it's imperative for people to organize and take action against the Trump administration's assault on human rights and human decency. Hence our weekly feature, the Old Mole Community Action Calendar. I'm sitting here with Bill Resnick, and we'll chat a little bit about some of the upcoming actions. First, I'll let you know what will help us get fired up for action this week that includes leading up to May Day. First of all, there's a discussion on Donald Trump and the working class, how we got here and how to respond. April 27th, Thursday, 7 to 9 p.m. It's presented by the Portland Democratic Socialists of America at the SEIU local out on 26th Avenue. It'll be a conversation between local and prolific journalist Arun Gupta and University of Oregon professor Joe Lowndes. Then on April 29th, Saturday, from 12 to 5, the Portland People's Climate Movement will begin in Dawson Park at North Williams and North Stanton. And it will be a movement of thousands led by Oregon Just Transition Alliance, a statewide network of Oregon's frontline communities. Then May Day itself, with the theme, All Power to the People, Rise Up, Resist, and Unite, the May Day marches, starting at Shemansky Park, with gathering at noon, rally at 2 p.m., march at 3 p.m. The organizers of this year's May Day march write, "This year, as we face a rising fascism and a dying imperialism, the Portland May Day Coalition calls upon every worker, every renter, every artist, every immigrant, every student, every teacher, every parent, every child, every union, every organizer, and every progressive, radical, and revolutionary organization in the city of Portland to rise up, resist, and unite with us on May 1st. We think it's worth noting that people are sensing a lull in the resistance in certain places, sort of the getting used to the Trump administration, and definitely the signs of the organizing for May Day are showing that's not the case, and same for the climate march and the science march that recently happened. Bill and I were chatting earlier about the importance of marches and general activism in keeping the momentum going, and it has various sorts of benefits to us beyond the actual revolutionary change that could happen, right, Bill?
Well, walking is good. You know, the people who live longest, even without modern medical care, they get enough food and clean water. They outlive us if, in fact, they walk every day. And for those of you who go to the gym like me a lot, I think we should all be, in fact, seeing those marches as really healthy and good for us and for our soul and for our intellect and for meeting friends. Anyway, there's a lot to be done this week, and it's really important because that's the way we show our strength and the resistance, and it really has an impact.
You had some thoughts about the science march that happened last week, too.
Yeah, right? You know, it was amazing, the science march Saturday, around the world, everywhere, even in Antarctica. Amy Goodman did a really good job on presenting it today. One thing that should be said, it was Earth Day, and it's a radical change in Earth Day. It represents taking back Earth Day from the corporations. You know, I remember last couple of years, there were clean coal booths. It was corporate. Mm-hmm. There were corporate
fancy brochures and
exhibits and stuff. Yeah, and whole booths,
right,
promoting greenwashing, basically. Mm-hmm. In fact, this year was a radical Earth Day. A march for the March for Science was very strongly made.
You think people got the message?
Well, those in the group in there got the message, and there were leaflets giving out, and people developed themselves, and they saw all of their neighbors. The talks were wonderful, at least the ones in Washington that I heard. Anyway, it was a great, I mean, we are really on a roll in some ways. There's a radical critique that is gaining in this country, including Bernie Sanders and the idea of the 1% and the 99%. It's become part of common language. Mm-hmm. The election can be really seen as an insurgency against both parties. Trump is horrible, of course, mm-hmm. but he's not a Republican, although he's now adopting the worst of Republicanism.
Yeah, still pretty amazing that we have to have a march for basic science, you know, paying attention to scientific truth. It's like things are really falling apart.
Yes, isn't that? But the climate march is going to, in fact, enhance and further and advance the critique of science, partly by talking about the, I think there was long on pointing out how alarming things have become. And in fact, we're really facing the possibilities of human extinction in the next 100 years. It's good at that. I think we're at the climate march, we're also going to be talking about all those alternatives. And in fact, there's another thing going on in town, the city council hearing and vote on 100% renewable energy. That's on Thursday. People should, maybe we can sum up all of those things, the dates. It's Thursday, the city council. There's a lot to be done next week, including Monday. Yep. There's a march for Palestinian rights. Look that up, mm-hmm. Jewish Voice for Peace in Portland. There's a lot to be done next week, mm-hmm. and put on your walking shoes. It's good for you.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Bill. You can check out the various calendars that have all of the activist events. There's a pdxactivist.org, I believe, and a activatehub.org, and the KBOO calendar itself. So this concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Todd Sloan. Patsy Kullberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two, and you can also find links to more information about guests and topics as well as past programs. This is KBOO Portland. Now stay tuned for, at 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein discusses urban biodiversity and efforts to promote human and ecosystem health by creating access to nature. At 11, Disability Awareness is off. Instead, Making Contact presents the documentary Mirrors of Privilege, Making Whiteness Visible. And at 11:30, Voices for the Animals talks about the U.S. Wildlife Service's war on wildlife. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by donating to KBOO, going to KBOO FM and clicking on Donate. So we're signing off from the Omal Variety Hour, listening to John Lennon's Power to the People.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and now stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor What the Festival at the Wolf Run Ranch, about 90 miles east of Portland, from June 16th to 19th. What the Festival is a weekend of interactive art, 8 stages of electronic and live music, speaker series, movement classes, and more. This year, performers include Zoo, Cut Copy, Grammatic, OTT, Big Wild, Rez, Sophie Tucker, Baker Matt, Paper Diamond, The Funk Hunters, and many more. Again, that's What the Festival, happening at the Wolf Run Ranch from June 16th to 19th.